Newbie Dice Podcast. Welcome everybody to another episode of Newbie Dice Podcast. Today we're going to talk about the evolution of the meta. So with me here, I have some esteemed guests. First up, we have Adam Ballard.
Hey everyone, how's it going?
Next, we have Tom Annis, our spy master.
Hey guys, thanks for having me on page. Looking forward to talking some more hot meta talk tonight.
And lastly, we have Matt Carmack.
Hey everyone.
All right, before we get things going, Matt is calling in from the hospital. He just got into an accident. And I did ask him, are you sure you still want to do this podcast recording? And he said, sure, he wants to do it. So there we are. I'm not slave driving him, even though when he's on bed rest. Matt, how are you doing? You could share as little as much as you want.
Yeah, this is collision on a motorbike, broken leg. So I'm going to be walking in crutches, presumably the next time anyone sees me in an event. But we're doing okay. So appreciate Paige for this welcome distraction.
Yeah, when I read that you got in an accident when you posted on your Facebook, I was like, shit, man, I've been posting rules question at you and I'm bothering you all this time while you were lying in hospital bed. Then you said, no, I just got into it. So I was like, oh, okay, at least I didn't disturb you while you were in the hospital bed. Yeah, and there's a GoFundMe going set up by Matt Carmack's friend because I don't think the insurance will cover everything. So any help rendered to Matt Carmack would be very welcome. I'll share the link in the podcast notes. So with that, let's introduce the credentials of my guests. Since we're already on Matt Carmack, let's talk about him first. Matt is one of the current RC members, that's the Rule Committee members. And let's share a little bit about your gamer and Kings of War history, Matt.
Yeah, so I've been playing Kings of War since the start of second edition, which was like 2015, I want to say. And I started playing, when I first started playing, it was mostly Rakan. And then I slowly played a little bit of everything because I was still trying to figure out kind of how Kings of War worked as a game system. I was mostly trying to make armies from a different game work in Kings, which was the wrong way to think about it. Instead, I started playing EOD, I started making armies that were designed to play in Kings. So I started playing EOD, notably played an all chariots list for the latter half of second, kept playing EOD into third, started switching back and forth between rats because I have enough rats to make some fun, call it not super hard meta lists, but like at least, you know, playable lists. And then was a playtester for several years and ended up on the RC somehow, magically. So
you are a great asset to the RC, I must say. So tip of the hat to you for all the work you have done. And I know you're in the hospital right now. You do have to focus on your recovery. So do make that a priority, right, buddy?
I did have, it was funny. I think there was a post on Facebook asking a specific question about secured position. And all I did was step in very briefly just to be like, yeah, there is an errata coming, guys. It's not here yet, but it is coming. Sean Green jumped down my throat immediately. It was just like, go back to bed. So I was just like, yep, no, that's, I'm taking it seriously, y'all. I'm trying not to, people who know me know that I'm a workaholic. So I'm trying my best.
Yeah, but you do have to surf your Facebook every once in a while. But as long as you're not doing hardcore work about rules, amendments, and stuff like that. Yeah, talking about Rakan, I thought Mantic's design of Rakan was pretty elegant. That's a little bit of history. In second edition Uncharted Empires, when Rakan was released, that was when the rally rule was first introduced. And it was available to most, if not all, Rakan hordes, horde units. And it's just one elegant rule to represent the effect of strength, or rather courage in numbers for the rats. And just that, I felt, was really elegant, because when you have your full army, everyone had above average nerf. But as you start to drop units, their nerf gets lower and lower. Just that little one special rule gave the faction a very cool identity and thematic feel to it. Yeah, so kudos to Bentic for that. Next up, let's talk about... Adam has been on my show for many, many times, so I'll go to you last. But I'm very honored to have the Spy Master grace our presence. Tom, do talk about your origin.
Sure. So I started playing Kings of War in late 2016, early 2017. I had never played any war games prior to Kings, so I'm not a Warhammer refugee. Didn't even know tabletop gaming existed. I just hit at the right time where I saw a friend of mine post on his Facebook, actually, a link to a YouTube video battle report that his army was a part of. And just scrolled Facebook one day, saw that, and it was the right time for me. I'd just gotten married, had a kid, and had a bunch of my friends move away. And I was looking for new social activities to engage in. And I've always been a big fantasy nerd. And so this just hit me at the right time. So I jumped in, hooked up with a local club called Dojo, which is a very competitive gaming club who just so happens to be based in the Dallas-Fort Worth area where I'm from. So I linked up with them. They taught me the ropes. And so I got interested, you know, what the best lists were and the meta more generally pretty early on in my King's career. And so I've been interested in it ever since. I got the moniker of Spy Master, I guess, because I started trying to figure out what other people were playing, both in my own region and more generally, and then had a reputation for kind of knowing what people were taking. And so it just stuck and has gone on from there. I've been to the Masters, I think, 5 years in a row. Not going to be able to make it this year, unfortunately, due to a family conflict, but always a part of the Countercharge kind of Masters preview podcast, and then often reaction, you know, Clash of Kings change reaction podcast. So I keep a pretty close eye on kind of what the meta is in the United States primarily, but also globally as well, to the extent I can.
Yeah, so you are on Jeremy Duval and the Scrying Gems over at Countercharge, right?
Right.
So yeah, right. That was another reservation I have about inviting you, because I thought that you already provide your voice and opinion on Countercharge. So I thought that we could have a different set of hosts here. But today I really wanted the Spy Master to be with us. And one of the reasons why you got the moniker is that you do save down all the lists from all the various GT, don't you?
I don't do as much as I'm not a completionist like I was before, where I need to have every list, but I do still keep tabs on things, just not to the point where I'm saving every PDF of every list in a Google Drive folder like I used to.
Yeah, I do have a mental image of you in a big trench coat, and then you pull it out, flip open your trench coat and pull out from the pocket the various lists from various events.
Yeah,
with that, I would like to invite Adam to give us his credentials, because I missed introducing you earlier properly because I've been having you on the show too many times, but I think the players deserve an introduction. So Adam, give us your origin and your credentials, and through the magic of editing, you'll go to the front and you'll hear me say this, but I don't care. Adam, go ahead.
Yeah. Hi guys. I'm Adam Ballard. I am a Warhammer refugee. So played Warhammer Fantasy through 7th and 8th edition up until it ended, and then quickly hopped ship over to Kings of War in the middle of 2nd, and been loving it ever since. As far as my Kings of War history, I started playing with elves, you know, end of 2nd edition. Clearly they were powerful, so why not play them? But I continued to play them even after their big hit in beginning of 3rd edition, and had a lot of fun doing that. But then I switched over to Empire Dust for a year or two, and then Night Stalkers would have been my last major army that I had assembled and whatnot, and that's the one that I'm pretty well known for, having won the Seattle Masters here in the U.S. with that list. So, and now I just, you know, borrow whatever I can get my hands on, because I don't know what I want to play anymore.
Yeah. And are you the only master that couldn't defend his title the next year because you became the hosting city? So you are not taking part in the following year's master to defend your title?
may have been, but I just look at it as I got a year off and, you know, this year is my true defense of the title. So but there's, you know, there's two champs stepping in the ring. So, Luke, you better look out. I'm coming for you.
With no list in mind yet. No army in mind yet.
Yeah, I don't know what I'm playing yet, but...
So with that, let's talk about today's topic. So the evolution of the meta. So it's just started with this idea in my head. And actually, it's just a hypothesis that I have. So I don't know if it's 100% true or not. So I'll just set the premise. And of course, we can discuss after that. And my hosts here, feel free to disagree or agree with me about this. So I was thinking about the evolution. The meta is like the current competition, the list out there, right? What are people fielding? So I was thinking about how it has been evolving since, of course, most of us started playing in second edition, but we have in the third edition, there was quite a big consolidation of the rules. So I think it's easier to start off on third edition. So when third edition started, there was not a lot of shooting and flying was very limited because a lot of the flying hordes and the shooting units, they were all irregular. So the basics of Kings of War, once a new player start playing, is that they will figure out that, oh, I should use my hammer units to, because they are effective fighting units, right? Most of them have aiding and attacks, hitting on trees, crushing strength 1 or 2, and you have Bane Chant support, so you can easily waver or route an opponent's unit. So the game started by revolving around that, and then you have chaff to deliver them. And slowly, and you just needed cheap chaff because at that time there was not a lot of shooting, so there's less fear that your shooting unit, your chaff gets shot off. And then it sort of evolved from there as the version. So when this was the list that you're expected to face, so everyone was deciding, how can I counter such a list? And I think back then in 2020, Eric Trowbridge did that really well by having Great Axe Hordes, which has that 20 over nerf. So you know that they can't one round you, but you can one round them because you're 25 attacks with Crushing Strength 2. So then after that, shooting became stronger because some of the units, shooting units became regular, and Heart Piercers and Flame Bearers specifically became really popular. So chaff kind of gets, they're afraid of getting killed off. So that's where Thick Chaff came in to deal with that problem. And then eventually, I forgot, Adam, do you remember if Glade Stalkers back then, why weren't they being used back then?
Glade Stalkers started third edition as irregular. And then I think it was either at the same time as the Flame Bearers and Heart Piercers, or it was one cycle after them that the Glade Stalkers got buffed, because not only did they become regular, but they went up to 3 unit strength. They went up from 10 attacks to 12 attacks, which was just a huge buff for them.
Yeah, I think they became regular at the same time, but they weren't buffed other than being regular yet. So then the next edition, they got extra attacks and extra rules, and that's when they started getting picked.
Yeah, that sounds right.
Yeah, so at first it was Flame Bearers and Heart Piercers. They had piercing 1, so a couple of them would kill off a chaff pretty easily, and even then they could pump some wounds into the hordes and the hammers, so they also fear the shooting. So then with the improvement to Glade Stalkers and generally bow shooting unit, the shooting meta started to come back to the forefront. And yeah, and I believe this, my hypothesis now is that it is not, the meta sort of shifted away from, you know, just having the hammer units, but you have an assortment of units. So it's not so simple anymore. The idea is not so simple. Your list building is not so simple. Just like, okay, this is my hammers, this is my chaff, how do I deliver my hammers? But there are many other considerations. You will have some medium strength units to have more threats on the board, rather than, because if you're just hammer and chaff, usually you are very elite and low unit count. That is what I've been thinking in my head. I'm trying my best to put it into words, but I think it's a little bit difficult for me to express it holistically, but I hope I get the idea across. And let's start with, who would like to comment on this first?
Well, I can go first. So you're right, Paige. The story of third edition, in a lot of ways, is the loosening of the reins of which were put on at the start of third edition. I mean, third edition was a very direct reaction to a lot of the perceived abuses at the end of second edition. So, for example, like you mentioned, a lot of the shooting units were made irregular. Elf shooting is an especially hard hit, even though its kindred archers were stayed regular. They went from four up range to five up. The flying units, the Drakons, or Forsaken, they were all made irregular at the start of third edition as a result of the lists that were around at the end of second. But gradually, as we've gone on, those restrictions have been lifted, for better or worse, and the meta shift across third edition in a lot of ways can be tracked by which restrictions were lifted when, and different units have different times in the sun before other restrictions get lifted. And then we're in a lot of ways back now today in 2024 where we were at the end of second edition, for the better, I think, but that's been the story.
Thank you, Tom. Anyone else?
Yeah.
Go ahead, Adam.
No, you go ahead.
I was going to say, with I feel like some of the swings have been very narrow and specific, and sometimes even regionally based. So there we saw some specific factions come to the forefront in, say, the Australian meta versus the US meta versus the English meta. You all had kind of some, I don't think it was all necessarily one smooth flow, but I do agree, generally speaking, that a lot of the evolution of third and the evolution of the meta in third, as far as the global meta is concerned, is definitely, you know, all these flying units were initially irregular. A lot of these shooting units were irregular and or not as stacked with 4+ and steady aim. And that the combination of making these units more regular, in the case of the flying ones, looking at you, Elohi, or giving some additional rules, sometimes maybe a little too much, Gladestalkers, it's kind of opened those doors a little bit. I don't think some of them were nearly as big of an impact as others. Like, I think the difference between a Lohi being irregular and a Lohi being irregular first, irregular or regular effectively, is a massive impact on the unit, basically, versus sometimes some other armies can get away with that, like when we saw Scorchwings, where they were irregular, but they were just super, super efficient. And so we saw lots of those for the brief period that they soared, pun intended.
Thanks, Matt. Adam.
I think one of the big things we haven't mentioned was the adjustment to magic items in particular between second and third, especially when it comes to ranged units, because I feel like in third, we're seeing a lot more of those, you know, meta picks or meta units are more like just multiples of the same units, you know, a spam basically. Whereas I think in second, we saw more of just a hyper elite, hyper effective units. So Elven, hordes of Elven archers is the big one that comes to mind, where you gave them a magic item that made them piercing. And then Bane Chant was also had the potential to give them additional piercing. And there was even a magic item that gave them +1 to hit at range. I think those certain things at the end of second were more of the abusive things that we saw creeping into the meta. So I do agree where, you know, a lot of the restrictions have been loosened on irregular and regular units now, but I don't think we're at a second edition abusiveness, because you can't really get a unit to be as efficient or effective as we could have at the end of second. And for good reason, I think we're in a much better spot, just in balance in general in the game, because those magic items, you know, certain armies just could abuse them more effectively than others.
Well, Adam, as you said this, it kind of gave me an epiphany that, you know, we're seeing some good units get taken in multiples currently, right, in our current meta. But what you said about magic items does got me thinking, food for thought, right? What if you introduce good magic items again, but then because only one unit could take it, then you won't see as much spam. Of course, everything has to be controlled and done in moderation, but that could be a way to curb like just spamming the same unit a lot of times, because only one of them can take this artifact that makes them better. So that's an interesting thought, because yeah, right now there is this instance of just a good unit just get taken a lot of times because it's just good, so might as well take it as many times as I can. We saw that in the Scorch Wing spam and the Skiff, Void Skiff spam, right? Nyx is also always mostly taken in trees because they're just so good, right? So yeah, I remember through the course of third edition, I started Green Lady back then, and unlocks were so difficult. I remember I had to bring a horde of elementals for that horde unlock. I brought a horde of men-at-arms for a second horde unlock, and I brought a regiment of the Brotherhood Knights, right? The normal knights, because they are regiment unlock, just so that I could unlock two characters and three monsters, because the Redemption Knights don't unlock. So I had two heroes, and the Redemption Knights were my third inspiring source. So everything was like a puzzle that fit perfectly together. Because I only had three unlocks, I brought two Beasts of Nature and one Pegasus. And then like, so throughout the editions, I've just been tweaking from that list. But then when I see what people are doing with Green Lady now, it's like, yeah, just take three Hordes of Forsaken and just go from there, because they unlock all the slots you need. Yeah, so list building has been quite different now with so many things becoming regular. Yep, go ahead. Anyone would like to speak?
Well, I was just going to say two things. First, on the issue of spam, usually the units that are getting spammed are under-costed. Like the Scorch Wings, they were 15 points under-costed at least when Jeff Radigan was spamming them at Masters, and some other people across the world were doing similar lists. And Matt, you don't have to comment on this, but I think the Void Skiffs and the Twi'lekkin list are probably 10 to 15 points under-costed. I don't know if that's going to get corrected anytime soon or not. But so when you see people taking 5+ of something, that's usually an indication that there's a costing issue with them. But I just wanted to say that and to remind people, like you just said, Paige, how difficult unlocks were for a lot of lists at the start of third edition. And so I think it's a good thing that a lot of these flying and shooting units have become regular to open up list building. And don't confuse, you know, taking 3 of something with taking 8 of something. Also, one part of the story that we haven't touched on, which I think is pretty important, is just how effective war machines were early in third edition and the response to that. So, Paige, you're trying to come up with a theory about starting with like kind of hammer and chaff type lists and evolving from there. Well, if you remember, thick chaff became a thing early in third, in large part in response to having to take units that were line of sight blocking, you know, cheap enough to be chaff, but tall enough to be line of sight block. Hammers or other important. So that's where like the Rev Cav and the Force Shamblers became in favor over, you know, the Gur Panthers or Gargoyles or something, which are still great. But when someone's taking 5 or 6 war engines against you, they're not going to hide your important units. Mm. And so that kind of thick chaff became a thing and remains a thing, maybe less so now. But that's kind of how that unit came into lists.
Yeah, you're right. I forgot about that part of history where the war engines were also a threat. And the thing about it is there's very little you could do, right, other than the thick chaff, because they ignore the shooting penalties. And it's also a very, how do you call it, very coin flip kind of things, because when they roll hot on the war engines, your unit just keeps dying. So yeah, so let's talk about currently, because we could go on about history, but I would like to relate this to the current meta and how we should go about doing things. So firstly is I do sense that there's less cheap chaff going around now, but rather effective units that don't cost too much, so that you are paying a little bit more, but they sort of do work. Other, you can still throw them away as chaff, but you could also have them do some work. So for example, the Phoenix, 140 points with a shooting attack, and they're tall, right? So they can shoot pretty well. And if need be, they can heal your units if the opponent outshoots you. And then after that, you can throw it away as chaff by charging into things. Height 6, they block line of sight to whatever they charge at. And then on top of that, they have a really good nerf. It used to be 16, 18. It's now only on the ancient Phoenix, but the baby Phoenix 15, 17 is still pretty great. You will probably get wavered, but getting killed off by one charge is not a given. And the moment it stays, you are profiting from that trade because the Phoenix is only 145 points doing so much work and it's shooting and healing before it's being thrown away as chaff. So stuff like that, I'm starting Northern Alliance now. So I see that a lot of lists packs, pack hunters, quite a few of them. So I call them discount Blade Stalkers. This class of units, you have them in Halflings, Varanger, Northern Alliance. What else? Which other factions have these discount Blade Stalkers? About 130, 140-ish points. So they do pretty good shooting as long as they don't move or something, because some of them don't have steady aim. And then they are decent in combat as well. They are cheap enough to throw away. So I see a lot of this rather than taking your regular chaff. What are your thoughts on that?
I think it varies a lot army to army almost, because like you talk about Phoenix as being, you know, this hyper efficient piece that like it can shoot a little bit. It can't, I mean, this might be a running theme for me of like, this is kind of one of the things that you look at when you're looking at these pieces. Not all armies have a piece that can do that, right? So like the Phoenix exists in what? Three armies tops, Brother Mark, Basilia, and Salamanders.
You're right.
Yeah. So with those three, I mean, yeah, in those three armies, I'd expect to see Phoenixes. But if you're playing Northern Alliance, you don't have a equivalent, really. Like, Pack Hunters do shoot, and they do fall kind of into the, like, yeah, they play two phases, which is a good unit, period. But I don't know that I would put them into, like, I don't know that I would treat Pack Hunters as chaff, if that makes sense. Like, they're I would expect to see Snow Foxes potentially, because they're high speed still. They're still really good just for the speed that they have. They can stay behind units and jump out at the last second. But nowadays, since they're buff, I've seen some Tundra Wolves start creeping in as chaff options. And with those, I'm seeing kind of the same pattern as to how most people have played chaff historically, which to me speaks a little bit that we're seeing not a resurgence of all-comer lists, but kind of a middle ground period where I think it depends a lot on what your list is trying to do. But I've seen people running those chaff either as objective scorers, where they never ever get into combat, like they're never put in front of things and never used as blockers. They're just there to run and grab stuff because of their high speed, which that seems to be a consistent thing, regardless of army, when it comes to chaff, is you need something fast. The faster, the better. But with the Tundra Wolves specifically, I've seen people using them as effectively extremely light hammers in addition, but it just kind of depends on the list and what they're trying to do with it. Northern Alliance actually has a decent amount of fast stuff, because between the Tundra Wolves, the Foxes, and now the Raven Divers, the
Frost Claw Riders. Is it Riders or Raiders?
Thank you. They will forever remain Raven Divers in my head just because of development. But yeah, the Tors Riding Ravens. Yeah, those guys are also speed 10. I haven't seen them used as chaff as much, but I have seen those prop up as regiments, which to me screams chaff piece. But then also, I mean, chaff, like, we could start getting into the definition of, like, what defines a chaff piece, right? Because, like, is a chaff piece something that is designed to die or designed to grab an objective? Or is it, like, because, it, you know, there's that famous saying from some Kings of War players somewhere that I'll attribute to maybe Dustin Howard, but everything is chaff, right? Like, in the right circumstance, you know, if I need something to get in the way to trade a piece, then, and the only thing available is, like, a pathos at 350 points, like, get in there, buddy. Like, I need you. So, but yeah, I think it depends a lot on the variety that's presented in a list. So in a list, I mean, like, the options that you can take within a list is kind of what determines what your chaff is going to be. And then even within that, it's what type of list are you trying to run within that army is going to make some of those decisions for you. And then the meta will have its impact on top of that. So that's how we drag this back into the actual episode of this podcast, is the meta, whether it's a local meta, a regional meta, so on, it it will have an impact on what you value Chaff as. So like Tom was just saying, when we had War Machines as a big threat in the meta, you wanted tall Chaff. That was just a thing. You had to have it because otherwise your stuff was getting shot behind it, didn't do anything, wasn't performing its role correctly. And now that the meta has shifted, we're looking at, if you ask me what Chaff is popular right now, it's just the biggest thing that speaks out to me is speed. So it's just fast Chaff, regardless of what it's doing. It needs to be fast, which has always been a beneficial thing for Chaff, but it feels like it's more so now. I haven't seen as much slow Chaff in recent years.
Yeah, anyone would like to chime in about that, about the Chaff topic?
Sure. Go ahead, Adam. I have some thoughts, and this might actually tie into kind of what Paige may have been trying to say. I actually think the meta as a whole is slowly adjusting to having more units in armies. So less focus on these big hyper elite hammers that can one-shot things, because we're seeing more units that are kind of the mini hammers, as people say, you know, like between that 1 to 170 point range probably would be a good guess. There's a lot of efficient units that still provide armies with a lot of tools that they need in the game, but they're pieces that you're much more willing to lose versus that 250 point hammer piece. So with this, I think we're seeing an increase in the amount of drops people have, where I think for a long time, early third edition, because it was very focused around how hard can I hit with these units, and then I'll throw in a couple of, you know, Chaff type pieces to help deliver them. We were probably looking at maybe like 13 drop lists 13 on to average. 15, for,
yeah, 13 is the elite.
Yeah.
My Green Lady list has always hovered at 13, which I know is the lower drop count, and people are going between 14 and 15 at the time.
Yeah. So I think that we're seeing that average increase. And I think a big reason for that is the need for these kind of middle tier type units that are in a slightly, you know, discounted range versus taking 4 or 5 units that fill out half your army, like 1,000 points for your army or something, and then fill out the rest from there. I think a lot of people are starting to look at these middle ranged units, you know, 150 point units instead of 250 point units. You can get easily a 15 to 17 drop army. I think we kind of see that in some tournament results, at least some of the major events that I can think of. I've been seeing a lot of armies that have, you know, the 15 plus drops. I know my Night Stalker list that I had won Masters with a couple years ago had 17 drops, and everything in the list was scoring as well. So it really revolved around just massive numbers advantage for me against any opponent and just swarming them. So I think we're seeing a shift towards that as the meta is evolving. But what do you think, Tom?
Yeah, I think you're right on, Adam. So I think this is something from chess, but your strong pieces get worth or are worth less for every weaker piece your opponent has. And so, you know, it doesn't matter how great a queen is if your opponent still has a couple of pawns to block it. And so I think some other changes, like we play at 2,300 points now and just kind of as the standard, whereas in second edition that was 2000 or 2150 or something like that, or I think 2250 was where we eventually ended up by the end. But so there are more points, so there are more units, so your uber hammers are not worth as much, because sure, you can kill, you know, one of my 15 units, but I have 14 instead of you kill one of my 12 units or one of my 10 units or something. That combined with the fact that we play blackjack scoring in a lot of our tournaments, at least in the United States, and I'm sure in Australia, is given that they came up with the system, uses it a lot too. But in that scoring system, it's not just that you win the scenario, it's how much you win the scenario by. So you need more units alive at the end of the game to win harder to get more points. And so those factors combined, has seen, I think, maybe the most significant change, which is just the rise of scoring units, not even unit strength, just number of units that score. And we, you know, we've been talking about this for a year or two now at this point, but it's still extremely important. You know, you can have a great killie list and just lose because you run out of units or you don't have enough time to kill everything in your opponent's army. You know, it's like the classic goblin problem. Unless you're killing them by turn two or so, you're probably going to lose the scenario just by virtue of how many scoring units they have. And so how that goes into the chaff discussion, you know, chaff is trying to solve a certain problem, which is, you know, it's really easy to lose your valuable pieces in one charge in King Gor. I mean, it's just, it can happen, unlike in some other games. And so you need to protect your valuable pieces. And there's a couple ways of doing that. Chaff is the cheap chaff that kind of hides behind your line and jumps out at the right moment is definitely one of those ways and is still an effective way. You know, you take one or two snow foxes or gargoyles or edge grenadiers or something. Those things absolutely do have a role. And I take them all the time where you can have units that can sit on the front line and don't have to hide behind your line and block charges. So that's, you know, infantry regiments is a good example. Skeleton spearmen, like Adam likes to take, can perform that kind of chaff-esque role as well. The way I think about it is a Drakon horde, for example, is 207 points, but an Ogre Warrior horde and a Rabble regiment is also 207 points. And all things else being equal, the Ogre Warrior plus Rabble regiment is going to come out on top because the Warrior horde is going to get the first hit on the Drakon's probably waiver and win the combat. And so that's another way. And then a third way, which is popular, is kind of the monster mash style where you don't have like chaff or medium chaff or blockers. You just have monsters where you use their high nerve, high defense, and base size to angle and ensure that you cannot one-shot them, you know, or very few units on a game. You know, maybe a Night Horde can one-shot a giant, but absent that type of unit, you're probably not one-shotting a giant. And then when you don't, you're in big trouble. So there's a lot of ways to solve the problem of how do I not get my own valuable units one shot? How do I move safely up into the board and toward the objectives that I need to win the game? And so, yeah, I'll stop there.
Right. Yeah. So I guess the gradual increase in drop count is actually countering the previous meta of more elite style lists, right? So if I have more drops, I can sacrifice more things to make sure that I come out on top. I eventually kill your big expensive unit. So yeah, that is the evolution of the meta itself, right? Because it started with more elite lists and now it slowly gravitate away from that because that's the way to deal with the elite lists, right? I have more sacrificial units, my weaker hammers can still get the job done because as long as I throw the chaff at you first, I win the chaff war, I'm still able to come out. Yeah, and I think hyper elite, rather very elite lists still work. I think the flying ones are still the most effective. Coming from my experience of Green Lady, why is it still effective is because my hammers charge 20 inches. My hammers tread a long ways away. And with so many of them, each of them have 5 to 6 potential charges. And what I commonly find is that the opponent will make a mistake. They would accidentally expose a flank. They would be blocking the front charge from the horde of flyers in front, but they didn't realize that my other flyers were just within 20 inch to charge its flank. So that is more like having the saturation of threat to hopefully make the opponent make a mistake so that you are able to find openings to get into. Yeah, that's all I have to say for now. I'm trying to think of another thought, but I kind of lost it. So anyone would like to chime in?
I generally agreed with Tom. Tom hit on one thing really, really hard that I think is absolutely accurate, which regardless of like the, that is such a hard thing to describe. I literally had this conversation with someone where they were like, what does that word mean? And I'm like, well, it's kind of a catch-all phrase for just the state of the game in a local region or in a defined region. But Tom pointed out very specifically, which I think is very true of the US. I don't know if this is 100% true in other regions, as much, but in the US specifically, one of the single biggest driving changes in third edition was whether it was not unit strength as a whole, but whether or not a unit scored. I think one of the biggest shifts from the beginning, and like we literally hit it already, we talked about how War Machines started out as this big scary thing, and one of the biggest reasons I think we saw a shift away from them is that in addition to them taking a hit to their offensive up, they also don't score. And we also saw a shift with individuals that way, where unless the individual was literally the best thing in the world or an incredibly efficient support piece, and even then, usually it was a case of like, well, is it a scoring support piece or not a scoring support piece? And you'd see like, you know, I don't know, Ratkin players would like run Warlocks, for example, but they would always run Broodmothers first if they had the opportunity, because one of those scores. And so you had this trend away from non-scoring things, and to the point where I think there was one Masters where it was like one list out of all of them didn't have, you know, everything scoring or something crazy like that. It was pretty impressive. Like most lists had at most one non-scoring unit. And that's all happening at the same time as, you know, shifts in power levels of things, you know, shifts in whether or not a thing is an unlocking unit, because lists are also having to deal with, you know, list construction problems. So there's I feel like there's so many different factors that impact, you know, what a regional meta could be, what an army's meta could be, because it's not even strictly like, you know, even within an army, you've got, you know, different viable builds potentially, if we're doing our job right, should have different viable builds. But even those, like, you have different like cycles of like, why is that happening? Why are these builds viable? And then some of that has to just do with list construction, right? Like, could you feasibly fit all this in a list, and does that list perform well at that point? So, because as you're talking about with these medium-sized pieces becoming more prevalent, which is good, generally speaking, that means you're seeing a wider diversity because more of the game is in the middle than it is at the fringe, so to speak. Like, there's more
units,
stuff,
more variety, right?
Right, right. So we're seeing good diversity there, but I do think that, one of the biggest shifts that we saw, which I think is still ongoing, is unit strength. Just whether or not it's a scoring unit and how much unit strength can you bring to the table.
Yep. To add on to what Tom mentioned earlier about the Monster Mash, the large infantry hero is also very popular, right? If your faction has one, whether it's a ogre character equivalent, most of them are ogre character equivalents, right? Whether it's in ogres or other factions, that large infantry hero, because they score, they're nimble, they're cheap enough to throw away. If they hit you in the flank, they still pack quite a punch together with whatever's hitting you in front that has a good chance of killing you. And that ogre, or rather large infantry hero, is also very popular. They are a scoring piece. Yeah, and just to add on for goblins, because I've been playing goblins for the last year, goblins has a lot of drops, but not a lot of scoring units, because you want to take a lot of the wizards, you want to take a lot of the war engines. So I have 20 drops in my goblin list. Only 11 of them score, because I have 5 war engines and 4 individuals. And I'm very conscious about trying to keep it at 11 and not lower. So it's more challenging than one thinks to field scoring units in goblins. And other than the rabble, most of the other things have only one unit strength or two, because you might have a slasher or a giant. Yeah, and the high unit strength is only in the goblins. So a lot of times I find that when I lose my rabble, I have to kill all of the opponent's hordes, because if not, my one winged or two wingeds is going to lose in unit strength to a horde. Yeah, so let's talk about what are we going to expect now in today's star. And I would defer to the Spy Master, because I think you still have your hand on the pulse of what are the lists to look out for out there when you're building a list. What are you expecting to face, and what do you expect that your list has to pack to be able to deal with these lists out there? Tom?
Sure. So we'll take a step back real quick. The kind of, when you're thinking about how to build your list, you should be thinking about a few different speeds. So there are a few important speeds in the game where kind of they're break points. One of which is speed 6. Another speed 9, and then kind of anything faster than speed 9. is its own category. And those correlate to shooting ranges of, you know, short range shooting is 12 inches, kind of medium range is 18 inches, and then long range is 24 inches. And so the game is a lot about threat projection and board control and how your specific faction is going to accomplish those things. So you need things that can threaten at those various breakpoint speeds. And if you don't have those, then your list is going to suffer. Like, for example, just to take the extreme, if you just take a bunch of dwarf infantry with no long-range shooting to back it up, that's probably not going to do very well. I mean, it's going to take up board space, but you're not going to be able to reach out and touch your opponent, and it's not going to go well. So just, it's hard to say, you know, you need to build your list to beat this specific, you know, list. That's a difficult thing to say, but if you generalize it a bit more into, okay, I need things that threaten at these different kind of breakpoints, that's how I think about list building. But what's popular right now, I would say mostly balanced lists, honestly, have been what have been winning tournaments kind of in this current Clash of Kings environment, with some exceptions. There was a Twilight Kin list that took, you know, 10 or 12 Void Skiff regiments with some Void Captains to give them rally and inspiring. But that, and then there was the tournament down in Texas that I attended. Matt, I don't know, I don't remember if you were there or not, but down in Houston in January, where Jeff Radigan won with, I think, 6 Forsaken Hordes, a knight, maybe one or two other inspiring units. And so there are the extreme spam lists out there, but generally what's been doing well is there's a lot of Northern Alliance that's doing well. You know, obviously Tom Robinson won the UK Masters with a balanced wealth alliance list. I think the guy's name is Brad Park. He won Pilgrimage in the Mid-Atlantic region at the beginning of March with a balanced 13 drop Northern Alliance list. You know, nothing special, but obviously piloted well. And then dwarves are also extremely popular right now. And so if you're thinking about what's out there in the meta, that's definitely something you have to realize how your list is going to combat dwarves. How are you going to deal with defense 6? How are you going to deal with long range piercing shooting from sharpshooters and, you know, Golok's Fury and that type of shooting? So the good news is that the list that you're going to be facing at the top of tournaments is they're pretty balanced, non-spammy lists with some exception, but that doesn't mean they're any less nasty, I guess, difficult to face.
Yeah, we were just joking in the chat that the Void Skiff spam list, they do equip guns, the deck harpoons, I think they're called. So that makes them a balanced list because they fight and they shoot. So it's just a very efficient unit that does both things really well, and combined with the Blood Hex and Weakness combo, they do are able to up their defense pretty effectively. So it does do everything, just that it just happens to be one unit that does everything. Yeah, I think if you're looking at, you'll be looking to face Alpha Strike lists specifically with lots of flying units, whether it's Green Lady or I think Basileia, you might be able to see that as well. So you have to be prepared for that. Next up, you have to be prepared for Defense 6, right, in Dwarves, and good long-range shooting, whether it's coming for dwarves or other lists. And I don't know if it's a trend for you guys, but I think healing is getting more and more common nowadays to be able to shrug off some of that shooting damage, or rather also to win the grind, right? If my unit somehow survives, it's on the other side of the board, I could heal it for a round or two before you send something else into it, and then I wouldn't be dying instead of being heavily wounded and going to die soon. So yeah, like I have invited Mike Rossi on one of my previous podcasts to share his master's experience. He was talking about dwarves. Yeah, they have high defense, they are tanky, but they do eventually die because he has no... Most dwarves don't pack healing. And recently, Jeff Trish won, I forgot, was it Masters, Clash of Kings with a dwarf list. And he did pack healing. And it's in the form of Stone Priests. I think they have Radiance of Life equipped. And then one of his Stone Priests have Celestial Restoration and Celestial Restoration is available to every single army. So any army can take some healing in Celestial Restoration. And he did say that, yeah, the healing did work. One of the anti-synergies is that Celestial Restoration is indirect. That means you have to be 12 inches, more than 12 inches away of what you're healing. And then when that happens, your Radiance of Life and the Inspiring will not be doing work. So that was one thing that was off. But other than that, yeah, I think healing is more popular to deal with the amount of shooting out there now, whether it's a shooting heavy list or it's just a balanced list that has just some sort of shooting, a decent amount of shooting. You are able to heal off and nullify those damage that this moderate list brings. So yeah, that's my thoughts about it. Adam, would you like to say something?
Yeah, I think that Tom covered very well kind of what you want to look at or consider when you're building a list specifically to combat other armies. I think that a big thing that also should be considered is building a list around the known scenarios that we're going to be playing. We've added a new scenario and adjusted a couple of them with this Clash of Kings. And I have a feeling that that is going to actually play a pretty big role in the meta and what types of units are being taken and what types of armies are kind of thriving, because specifically the stockpile and the hold the line scenarios are scenarios that require you to go up the board rather early in order to start scoring. You know, it's almost semi, progressive scoring. We haven't really gotten to progressive scoring yet, but the stockpile especially feels almost like we're on that verge. So I think units and armies that are able to kind of go up there, put themselves in threat range and be defensive enough to hold their ground, going to do well in those scenarios. And I have a feeling that we're going to see those scenarios pretty often in larger events, being that they are new, and I think they're pretty well balanced as well. So knowing that you're going to have scenarios and most of them require you to move and get into certain positions, and some of them require you to hold loot tokens, just knowing what units' roles are needed in order to effectively play all those missions. It's tough to be able to really do all of them well, but at least make sure that you can do half of them extremely well and the other half still have a fighting chance at least. So it's really tough to kind of dissect, and that I feel like is its whole separate podcast of what units really do well at what. But I think the scenarios are definitely going to affect the current meta as it is.
Yeah, adding on to that, I played Goblins in Hold the Line and Control. Some people might think they're quite similar, but Control, the six squares, right, include the squares, extend all the way to your deployment zone. So there were times in Control where I look at the turn ends and I said, I don't have to come forward. I'll just stay there and shoot. Whereas Hold the Line, I have to push forward because the scoring zone is in the middle box. So if I don't push forward early enough, I might be blocked out of the zone. So I could kill a lot of his stuff, but whatever he has remaining is still in the zone, and he could send a few things just to block my rebel from going in, and then my opponent would win on the scenario there. So another thing to talk about is push, right? With the change that you can only score with one unit on each, carrying each loot token, that has increased the requirement to bring more loot carriers, basically. Previously, you just need one slow unit. If you're an Alpha Strike list, you just need, this is my token carrying unit, whether it's the regiment of men at arms or the, for me, it was the Horde of Earth Elementals, but now you probably need at least two instead of just the one. And I think based on the current wording, you are able to carry multiple, but you only score one at the end of the game. Is that the consensus right now? I don't know if the RC is going to amend it to make sure that you could only carry one.
No, I don't think they can.
Yeah, so they can touch on that a little bit. That is the correct consensus, is it's you can carry as many as you want, you can score one at the end. The reason that you can carry as many as you want was the final decision on that, because In my mind, I feel like the scenario actually would play better if it was you could only ever carry one. The problem is that the way loot tokens are written, if you kill a unit that has a loot token, you have to pick it up. So it would require more finagling with more things, which could have wider reaching impact to change one scenario, that being push. Versus just doing it the way that we have right now, where it still effectively forces you to bring more units, which is the goal, to help break up kind of the you put everything on one unit and push it forward and call it a day. So this, I do think that both solutions would help. One was just a lot more in depth than the other, and we were going for fast and quick over giant sweeping changes to how loot tokens work.
Yeah, if you were to modify it such that one unit could only carry one, then yes, you have to add a lot more rules wording, and that's only specifically affects push. So yeah, so that's why this is a more elegant situation that we're in right now. Yeah, anyone else has anything to add to this conversation right now? No, looks like we have pretty much covered it. So with that, I hope that has provided enough food for thought for veteran and new players alike, because I do think that the evolution of the third edition and the meta that we have now also sort of mirrors the journey of a new player, that you will see what immediately grabs out at you. And then as you play, you realize that there's more considerations to think about and your list will slowly evolve, because at the start, it's very easy to say, oh, I take this big hammer unit, I kill everything, that'll be a good day for me. And then when you realize that the meta, they're able to counter that strategy, then you have to evolve your strategy, and things are not as, I think it's good that things are not as straightforward now, that there are a lot more considerations. Last thing I'd like to talk about is the all comers list, because I think because of the many considerations that you have, people end up making all comers lists, right? Because you have to potentially face all the different types of lists out there. So I was just toying with this idea that would Kings of War benefit from something like a two list format or sideboard format? Do you think, I mean, one of the biggest restrictions to that is because Kings of War being an army sized game, you have lots of models to bring and paint. So that would be a bit prohibiting. But if that wasn't an issue, would a two list format be beneficial for the meta? What do you guys think?
I don't know if it would work in Kings of War, just because most matchups are just a single head-to-head. And I feel like most game systems that have like sideboards and things like that are a multi-game head-to-head, you know, at least a best of three, where you have the opportunity to then, you know, adjust to the matchup after the first game and so on. So I think it would be very difficult to have any true impact in Kings with only one game being played for any event.
Yeah, I actually just got done playing. My last tournament was Bayou Battles in Houston, Texas, and we were able to bring two different sideboard lists. I forget exactly the number of points the sideboard could be, but, you know, on the margins it helped. You know, I picked of all speed list for invade, and then a more, you know, unit strength or objective focus variant with ultra primes and units like that in the second list. But because of the restriction that the cyborg can only be so many points, one list eventually was just better, and that was the Snultral Prime list. So even in scenarios where you would think I'd want the all speed, or matchups I want the all speed, I just took the more balanced version. So if you could take two completely different lists that didn't have to overlap at all, that would definitely have an effect on the meta. But I don't think you'd agree with that. It's not really practical in Kings, given the size of the armies and the number of models they are. It just would be way too prohibitive.
Yeah, because I played War Machine and Hordes previously, and it was very commonly a two-list format. You only play one game, right? But at the beginning of your game with the opponent, you will each select your own list in secret, whether it's list one or two, and then you review it at the same time. And usually in that format, you will bring one dominant list. You have a list that is quite terrifying, but then it might have a weakness or two. And then if your opponent has a list that can counter your dominant list, then you would field your B list. And then there's this concept of list chicken. So then you have to guess which list your opponent is going to bring. Is he gonna fill the list that counters your A list? And then you throw out the B list, but in the end, he chose the B list that could counter your B list, you know, things like that. So that's a bit of a mind game in itself. But yeah, the practical concerns, right? The army is too big that you can't really, it's not practical to carry two armies to Kings of War tournaments.
Right.
Yeah, with that. Oh, Matt, go ahead.
I was going to say, I do think that doing, like, call it different lists to an event is a little bit unfeasible just due to the logistical concerns that people are bringing up. I do think that doing stuff like scenario drafting, which allows you to play lists differently, would be an interesting format for a tournament. And especially now that we have, someone actually brought this up in a, I forgot if it was a Discord call or just on the fly. I'm guessing it was one of the mini conversations just in a Countercharge or something like that. But now that we have 14 scenarios, one of the solutions is just drop them. Drop it down to 12 so you don't have to roll the awkward dice to figure out what the scenario is now. You have both players pick one that they don't want to play. And that way you can narrow it down. But I think you could take that further and literally have a like scenario draft where each player picks like one scenario they want to play and what, like, you'd have to do some finagling with it. I'm not going to write out what that would look like right off the top of my head, but I do think that there's some room for if you wanted to have some meta swing, having control over the scenario, I think would allow you to do that without forcing you to bring a whole other army. So it's a little bit more practical in the logistics, but still something that allows you to do kind of that chicken, that draft, you know, if it were the problem, I think, is it becomes logistically challenging for tournament organizers to do that, because you'd have to be like, well, I want to play this scenario at this mission, right? Like, you know, I want to do domination with my dwarves against EOD for whatever reason. Don't do that. That's a bad idea. But then, like, instead of against like elves or something. So like, but then you have to keep track of like, where have you used the scenario? Like, it could be interesting. I don't know that it would ever get codified into like Kings of War rules, but I think it would be an interesting thing for a tournament to try and then send me the results of.
Like, actually, I was just going to say Lady of the Lake, that's something that they've had built into their tournament for the past several years. Is a list of like 9 or 10 of the scenarios, and you pick a scenario, your opponent picks one, you both do that blind and then reveal which one was picked, but you're playing both scenarios as both parties. So you might have a pillage and a dominate game. So they're usually lesser, you know, with like pillage tokens, there's usually only 3 tokens out there instead of 7, knowing that there's going to be another scenario that's being played. So it works pretty well for that event. It's definitely one of my favorites, and it's really fun. It's unique, but I would say that it's also not something I would want to play every event. So
yeah, I think this is a great conversation that, okay, since it's impractical to bring two different lists, you can have possibly different scenarios so that you are able to approach differently. So that's pretty interesting. I think there was a team tournament. GT, was it? The team tournament? Because you get to choose a matchup. And then I think you are able to choose tables or get to choose a scenario, I think. So you could plan favorably to either the table or the scenario.
That would be Crossroad GT, their four-man team tournaments.
What were you able to choose? Was it the table layout or the scenario that the player will be playing on?
It would be scenarios or matchups. So there was a process of each of the four-man teams would blindly put forward 2 individuals from their teams before knowing who has the priority of picking scenarios or matchups. And then there would be a roll-off, effectively. The players would be revealed, and whoever won the roll-off would decide in the matchup of those two, would they want to pick the scenario or would they want to pick the matchups? And right. Then it switches for the remaining 2 players of each team. If you pick the matchups in the first 2, you would pick the scenarios after the matchups were decided by the other team.
Yeah. That's another way to handle that, but that also only works in the team format. So the in the singular format, the Lady of the Lake method also works because you get to both have a decision on the scenario that you want to play, the half scenario that you want to play. So yeah, great, interesting conversation that we have. And I think that just about rounds it out. Tom, do you have anything you want to add?
Only that, you know, talking about the meta tonight, we are in a really good place, I think. Like Adam said, a lot of the restrictions have been lifted, but the abusiveness of the end of second edition is not present at here, you know, many, what are we, 5 years into? We're in a really good spot where, especially after the last two Clash of Kings packs, there are so many viable armies, so many viable units within those armies, different play styles. You know, there's just so many more community resources that can help you with list building and discussing the meta and army reviews and things like that. That we're just, I'm really happy and proud of the people who have made it happen. You know, the RC first among those, but also everyone else who's put thought and care into making this game what it is today. I mean, the rules and the balance of the game is a strong selling point for Kings. It has other drawbacks, but on the table, there's no game that beats it. And so maybe on the edges, there's some units that deserve tweaking, and I have full confidence that they will be tweaked if they deserve it. But just want to close out by saying, you know, what a great place we're in today.
Yeah, and I think we will never be able to achieve perfect balance, right? There's no such thing. So the balance ebbs and flows. So when stronger units get nerfed in the next clash, for example, some other unit will come to the forefront because maybe the thing that got nerfed is actually a predator of this unit. So now with the predator getting nerfed, the prey gets stronger. So it ebbs and flows. There's always some units that's just a little bit too good. I would think that in Kings of War, it's not egregious and it will get addressed in the next clash for sure. So it's not egregious and you'll get addressed. Yeah. So I think, yeah, kudos to Matt on the RC for keeping the game in a good state of balance, and that keeps everybody happy. Right. With that, let's go on to our hobby updates. So let's talk about what armies you have, what you have brewing in the background, be it that you are painting and assembling units up or that you are testing out lists. What is the list or the lists that you have been testing out lately?
So I've been full on halflings, finally getting that done after over a year of talking about it. I'm in a weird spot since I'm not going to Masters this year. I've got my next tournament that I could build a new army for is not till late September. So I've got, you know, 6 months at this point to get something done. So if I don't get it done now, then I'm never going to get it done. So I'm all halflings all the time right now.
I really love the halflings. I think they're in a really good spot. My buddy got ran halflings at UK Clash of Kings last year. He was the second best placed halfling player and the best placed halfling player actually won the whole thing. And then right after that, Clash released and halflings got buffed even further. So I really love the poachers. I think they are one of the best because they are that discount glade stalkers that come with stealthy and spell ward. So it's really hard to shoot them back in return, especially when they scout up into a forest and just sit there the whole game. Anything shooting at them will be hitting on sixes, or even, yeah, anything shooting at them will be hitting on sixes, right? So what's in your halfling list? What are the units or lists that you're trying?
I forget my exact list right now, but it's generally 3 to 5 units of poacher, 1 to 2 iron beasts, 3 aeronauts, 2 of the flying air lizards, and then kind of seasoned to taste at that point. So
3 to 5 units of poachers. So, yeah. And you did say that the spam was at 5 to 8, right? So you better be fielding 4 instead of 5.
I was just waiting for the follow-up. 3 to 5 troll gunners.
Right. What's your take on troll gunners? My buddies say that the lack of steady aim does keep them in check, but they got the piercing one. Was it for free?
Yeah, which I'm always suspicious of when units get stat buffs for free. But I think they're okay since they're irregular. If they're irregular, they'd quickly become a problem. The heroes, though, are incredibly amazing.
They were good before that buff.
Right.
Are you running sorcerers?
No. No, I never have. I don't like them.
Yeah.
They're too random.
Yeah, I think sorcerers are really quite a what do you call it again? Like either you take them or you don't. People have very split decisions about them.
Yeah, especially when compared to the Twilight King Navigator, it just makes me feel real bad.
Right, Adam, what are you working on?
Working on trying to figure out which of the armies I have currently I'm going to be playing, because I don't have time or feel like building up a new army. But I've been playing a decent amount of UB. There was an event that happened recently, the Quail Cup, and I started the event playing her just because I wanted to prove people wrong when they were bitching about Longhorns. And I think that Longhorns are actually in a good spot right now. And then after getting through the group stages and finding that people weren't taking this tournament a lot more seriously than I thought, I was like, well, I don't think the herd are going to actually cut it out, make the cut. So I switched over to what I think is a little bit more of a competitive list and played some Riftforged Orcs and did pretty well with it. Ended up taking second place in the event. So very happy with that result.
Yeah, you were streamed in the semifinals, but I didn't watch that. What's in your Riftforged Orcs? Were you about to switch lists in between rounds?
There, you were to a certain point. So you were locked in on armies. There was a group stage, like mm-hmm. a pool play. And then there was the bracket play after that. You had to lock in armies for the entire pool play. And then you could switch when going into the bracket play. So that's where I made the switch. But you were allowed to then switch the list itself throughout at any point in time, basically. So, right. But I usually like to keep the same list. And this is one of the few times that I switched armies in general. So, but my Riftforged Orcs, I took a couple of Reds of Unforged, a Horde of Unforged, a regiment of the Legionnaires, two war drums. I mm-hmm. took the Shrine, took two Hordes of Hellstrike. What else did I take here?
Very balanced. Do you have any shooting other than the Shrine's lightning bolt?
Yeah, I have two Amberoxes. I have a Storm Giant with a Slayer. Then I took two mounted Riftforgers with Host Shadow Beast and Thonar. So 15 drops, 27 unit strength total, three individuals. So it's a lot more individual heavy than what I would normally play. But I found that those individuals have a lot of value. So they put out a sneaky amount of damage.
Did you say Riftforgers? Two Riftforgers.
Two mounted Riftforgers with Host Shadow Beast 3.
Yeah. Oh, they're already spellcaster too. Wow.
Yeah, so they effectively have 7 attacks when you get the Host Shadow Beast off on them. So, and Thonar quickly became my favorite individual in the game. I think that guy is just money.
Minus one to hit.
The minus one to hit's great. But, I mean, that guy's good for, like, 5 damage on average against most things. So, he's a lot of fun. So,
yeah, with the Stormstrike. So, you averagely rolls 1-6, right? So,
well, his works on 5s and 6s. So,
oh, right.
He normally has, on average, you roll, you know, with his 6 attacks, he'll have 6 hits because of the blast from the 5 and the 6.
Yeah.
And then crush 2, like he's, you know, he's putting out 4 or 5 wounds against defense 4 or 5. So,
yeah. Did the minus one to hit ever come into play method in certain games?
I mean, it definitely had impact. I don't know if it really adjusted a breaking point in any key situations, but I just kind of was trying to test the real limits of the list and usually threw Thonar out into really difficult situations and it worked out for me. So I got pretty lucky not to lose him in situations I probably should have.
I was wondering why you ran Unforged Orcs. I haven't taken a deep look at Riftforged, but I haven't heard this unit being taken much until I realized they have the Orc keyword. They get Rally 2 from the drums. Is that why you're taking them at a cheap price point?
Yeah, they're cheap. They unlock. I found that the Riftforged Orcs really like their monster and hero unlock slots. So that's where I got a lot of them.
Two Wardrons and the Giants, right? Oh, and two Emberoxes, yeah, that you need a lot of.
Yeah, and then the Stormforge Shrine is a Titan as well, so I have seven monster slash Titans.
How's the M seemed a little expensive, so what do you think?
They're really great. Two of them together. I think I played against Jeff Trash actually in one game, and I don't think it was for the event, but those guys, sometimes they go off, and when they go off, they're effectively a scoring war machine in my mind. So I'm paying a little bit more than what I would for a war machine, but they score, they're mobile. So I really liked them. They've, you know, two of them together can pick up a unit that you didn't expect, and you kind of need a little. I always like to have a little bit of shooting just to threaten some chaff and, you know, pick up some light type units. So, and they, if they're not able to really pick up anything, they just put wounds on stuff that these individuals eventually go run into and will clean up later. So
nice, but you're not gonna run Rift Forge Orcs at Masters, are you? You don't have.
Yeah, I don't have them, so.
So still up in the air.
Yep.
Matt.
Adam.
Oh, Tom, go ahead.
I was just going to say, Adam has such a great club up there in Omaha that I'm sure he could run whatever he would like, and they will build and paint it for him.
I don't know. I might have spent all those brownie points. Now they're just like, yeah, we're worried about ourselves. You play with what you got.
Right. Matt, go ahead.
Yeah, I haven't had a huge amount of time for modeling, which is also code for saying that I'm lazy and have played the same armies consistently for the last ever, and then use UB when I want to play something new and different. But in terms of, because I am stubborn, I will make that, I will put that chariot list through the paces every freaking year. But this year, for, I had ambitions, and still do, of going to Clash in the UK. I do still have a ticket. And I had every intent of getting a Twilight Kin list up and running, mostly because it would be an all Mantic list. But my Ratkin are like 80% Mantic, but there's still chunks of other stuff in there. And then my Empire of Dust is basically not Mantic because they did not have the chariots out when I built the list. And rather than trying to rebuild all of the chariots in Mantic, I would like to try and get something new on a table, but still something that kind of plays like what I'm used to. So I was looking at kind of a hybrid, not quite the spammy spam, but I'll be honest, your definitions vary on what spam is. I've learned recently that spam could literally just be more than two of a unit. So, you know, when that's what we're dealing with, you know, there's only so much I can do. But, and given that the two main units in the list are four of and six of respectively, you know, take your pick as to whether or not that counts as spam. But I do have plans to try and get that ready for Clash. I might ask if Mantic can help with that, whether or not they have a studio army there that I could borrow to make it work or get some assistance, because I'm also worried about flying the army there. That's a new experience to fly an army. I mean, I've done it before with the EOD and it was not pretty. So I'm kind of like hoping not to replicate that. I'm sure my British friends have had similar experiences bringing their stuff over here to our events. But this year, last year I did the live cast for Masters, and this year I will not have to do that. It'll be up in Washington, but I want to take the opportunity to do Clash since I've never done Clash. And I have not been to England in a hot minute. So it's trying to cover some things, multiple things with one, you know, one trip. But yeah, so slowly piecing that together. The nice thing is that a lot of stuff is on the vault, so that helps. So I've got four units of Soul Flayers, six units of Skiffs, and then Season to Taste. But it's the seasoning in this case, I think, is Mikey. I think I had two of the captains. I don't remember. It's either one or two of the captains. I did not take Crones. That was the big thing. Yeah. So just not a huge fan of the Crones. They're good. Don't get me wrong. They're definitely really, really good. But it is mostly just going for something that's similar to how I play the Empire of Dust list, just slightly different in the style. and I have a lot of with that style of not full speed list. Like it's still only speed 8 at the top for the most part, but it has a lot of tricks to, you know, get you at weird angles and lots of wind blast and lots of different heights. So between all that, I've had experience running that type of list, and so I want to have some fun with it before inevitably skiffs get figured out by everyone. Because they're probably a little too just a smidge.
Right. Awesome. Hope you'll be able to build your list in time and be able to fly down, have a good time. Clash of Kings UK this year is set to be the biggest Kings of War event again. So that'd be amazing. I know Adepticon is around the corner. Is it next weekend? Are you guys going?
I will be there. Don't know what I'm playing, but I will be there.
Aren't lists
used? I don't know if they have a due date for lists because they don't do like a matchup cast or anything. So
I think there's a player pack and a list due date.
Yeah.
You I'll better check on that. Tom, you were saying?
Oh, you're saying I went last year and it was a great time. I'm not going back this year, but if you can go, you definitely should.
Yeah, one of my local Singaporean players is going for Adaptive Clash. He's actually a competitive X-Wing player. So he's actually going there for X-Wing. He started playing Kings of War in February. He was a Warhammer Fantasy veteran for sure. Then he's pretty comfortable with his skill level in X-Wing. So he was able to take up a second game. So he dove into Kings of War hit first. And 6 games in, I had a game with him last Wednesday or something. Then I sent him the Adaptive Clash player pack. I said, you're going to Adaptive, right? Would you like to consider playing in the Kings of War tournament? And the tournament dates did not clash with X-Wing. So like I poisoned his brain. So half an hour later, he showed us a picture of him paying for Adaptive Clash. And he borrowed an ogre army because his army is not painted at all. He borrowed an ogre army from our local players to bring down because ogres are compact. So he will be playing there. So Adam, look out for him.
Nice. Yeah, for sure.
New, but he's a veteran wargamer. So I think he would do pretty well. I'll put my bets on him. Lum, better bring it back. Bring back some good results. And yeah, for myself, I'm working on Northern Alliance as my new army. I've been playing goblins for the past year, but actually my army was only fully built. My physical army was only fully built in November, but I've been playing a lot of UB beforehand. And then I still played physically, but the hordes of Rebel, right, were not done. So those were the last to be completed. So, but they were just a few units. There were a lot of models, but there were just a few units that could easily be proxied. I did the rest of the stuff first. So I've been playing goblins for a year. I think they are a pretty good army, but it is goblins, or rather the shooting goblins in itself is a sort of a skill list in terms of being shooty and trash. I do feel, might be my own personal bias, I do feel that they are not all comers enough, because being a shooting skill list, there are certain matchups that don't bode well for them. Specifically, if your army has a lot of stealthy, they're going to have a hard time. If you have a lot of high defense, they're going to have a hard time. I fought in Clash of Kings Asia. In the end, I lost to the eventual winner because his list is Wraiths and Zombie Trolls with Drain Life support. So it was hold the line, and eventually I lost because his 2 regiments of Wraiths charged into the center rebel and sat there the whole game, and the center had a forest. So his two Wraith regiments were in the forest the whole game. So I'm hitting on 5s, wounding on defense 6. So it was really hard to peel them off with my shooting. So, yep, Northern Alliance, I've not played a lot of games of it. So I really want to really try the list more. I think the list definitely needs to be tweaked, but I'm liking Pack Hunters. I'm bringing 3 regiments of them. I still love the Hearthguard. I'm inspired by Travis Tim. So I brought Hearthguard with Dwarf troops to support them rather than Snow Foxes and Wolves. And I like the formation, so I'm taking the formation. I think there are like 125 points for 15 attacks on trees with Crush 1 Thunder 1 while charged. 3 Tundra Fighters, yes please. So they hit really hard for their points. You do have to screen them a little bit, but Dash 13, 14 with Rally 1 from the Frostclaw Regiment babysitting them, and possibly another Rally 1 from Telenar's Standard. Yeah, trim the mandatory, in my opinion. And yep. One interesting thing
was... If you play North Alliance, you play Harim.
And One interesting pick is the Ice Queen with healing and conjure staff for healing support. I do like healing in my list nowadays. So this is the list I'm playing around with. I need to get more games in with this list and then tweak from there. 17 units. That's pretty high. 25 unit strength. Only two individuals. Yeah, and the paint scheme that I have for it will take a long time. And I have a lot of infantry. I realized, I was like, if I were to do all of them in preferred model count, it is 120 infantry models. Like, I just came out of goblins with 6 hordes. That's 180 goblins. Now I'm going to paint another 120. So we'll see how it goes. I saw that the pack hunters, the way some of them put it on the base because of their flowing cloak and dynamic poses, you can't really fit a lot of them. So I think I could get away with less than PMC for them. Yeah, and the paint scheme I have for them is very time consuming. So this could be a year or 2 year project to get the Northern Alliance fully done. So I will be playing my goblins still. My current goblins has double titans, one giant and one slasher to shore up the weakness of being able to take out defense 6 with my giant and have a more punchy piece, and both titans are unit strength 2 now, so decent unit strength being that I only have rebel at 3 and then my wing is at 1. Yeah, with that, thank you everybody for coming on the show. We are coming up to 2 hours, so I think that's a good time to wrap it up. Anyone have any shout outs before we wrap up the show?
I got one call out. I think that the reduction in Phalanx is actually going to be pretty big. And we did not discuss that in our meta discussion, but just want to call out cheap Phalanx. Good. I've been playing Phalanx before it got cheap and it was still good. So I expect a lot more people will have Phalanx going forward.
Yeah. The thing is, it's not in every list, right? Not every army has access to cheap Phalanx. So I guess that's why it's not being talked about as much. All right, with that, I'd like to thank everybody for coming on. Thank you, Tom.
Thanks, Paige.
Yeah, Matt.
A pleasure.
And thank you, Adam.
Had fun. Do it anytime.
With that, keep newbie dicing. Bye, everyone.